All right, welcome on to a Sunday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Danny and I are back. We haven't had a chance to do the traditional Sunday night 30 and 60 for a while, so what we're actually going to do is split it up into 2 days. We'll run the second half of the league tomorrow, and so this will be more like 15 and 60, and we'll get a little bit more detail on each of the teams. Danny, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you feeling?
Pretty good, pretty good. Ready for this road trip to be over, but I still have one more game left in it at Golden State at Indiana on Tuesday.
What a game, though. I mean, that I'd be more excited about attending that game than any of the ones we've done.
Oh yeah, no, this is gonna be an awesome game. I mean, I think pretty clearly it's their biggest chance of losing on this road trip, right?
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. Who else do they have? They have Boston and then somebody who's not that good, right?
Yeah, they have, I'm trying to remember who it is. It's somebody who's not that good on the tail end of a back-to-back. That's one of the fortunate things for the Warriors on this trip is that the two back-to-backs they have, the second team was inferior.
Yeah, all right. Well, anyway, we can talk more about them when we get to it, but let us start with our traditional first team, the Atlanta Hawks. They are now 13-9, 3-3 since we last did one of these. Kind of about right where you would have thought that they were going to be, frankly, huh?
Yeah, I think that's about right. And the guy, I wouldn't say it's been a surprise, but the story for me for them has been that Paul Millsap continues to just be great.
Yeah, when ESPN's RPM numbers came out, he was very high in those in the top 10. He's traditionally been very highly ranked in those since he's been with the Hawks. Somehow, you know, you would have thought he would take a little bit of a step back this year since he's turning 30, but he is not, and he's doing it in a pretty sustainable way. He's shooting 25% of his shots from long range, still hitting his usual, you know, 35%-ish, but has really upped his ability to get to the line on a team that doesn't have a ton of guys who do that.
Yeah, and something I was thinking about this week was, with the success that they've had, imagine how awesome he would be if the Magic had ended up being able to pry him away from Atlanta.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, although they have so many other awesome power forwards, and who knows, I bet you Scott Skiles would have just decided to bench him for entire second halves and they'd still somehow be, you know, like 15-5 or something right now. It's just because that's just like how the Skiles voodoo seems to work, I guess.
And an interesting question that you posed as we were kind of planning this was talking about the difference of two different guys that were kind of, I wouldn't necessarily say they were both on the radar, but they ended up getting Tiago Splitter with a little bit of money with that commitment once they kind of figured out they weren't going to be able to retain Carroll. And you brought up the idea of whether Aaron Aflalo would have made more sense for that. Personally, for me, I think I would have gone with Splitter just because I think he is something that is actually a little bit of a rare commodity. And I don't think the bigger issue is that I don't think Aflalo is so good at what he does that he would solve that problem.
Yeah, I mean, for people who don't remember, they got Splitter essentially for nothing as San Antonio was trying to clear some space. And I think Splitter is a better player than Aflalo in a vacuum. Now, you could say that they kind of needed Aflalo as another guy on the wing, and he's been playing okay for the Knicks, not great, you know, kind of lower-end starter. But Splitter really hasn't done much. He's been out again. You know, he always seems to have some nagging injuries. He really hasn't played that much even when he has been in there. I think they're kind of saving him for the postseason. I think I ultimately would rather have Splitter, too, just because he filled a need that wasn't really going to be available for them at that price range, you know, about $8 million a year or so. That's why I compared him to Aflalo, because his contract was essentially the same as what Splitter's is for the next 2 years. And so I think Splitter still can help them, especially against a big team like Cleveland. He, you know, theoretically should help with the rebounding, although he hasn't yet. So we'll see. I think that's more of a move for the playoffs, but he has not been particularly helpful during the regular season so far just due to the low number of minutes he's played.
Yeah, and they're a team that I think right now you would say that you're pretty comfortable that they're going to make the playoffs, right?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, they have about a, you know, 2.5-ish net rating the last time I looked, and I can see them just, I mean, I think they're kind of essentially right about that level, you know, for their record, 13-9, and I see them kind of, you know, a little bit below 50 wins type of team, and that's still going to get in this East, even though they're a little bit better.
I'm going to let you talk about Dennis Schroeder because I don't have the heart to. My boy.
Yeah, he's been struggling a little bit. And, you know, last year was a year where he actually seemed like he broke out. His PR was in the high teens. That's down now, and even most of it is based on usage. Some really ugly shooting numbers from him. And although he has a lot of quickness, his ability to finish really from any area of the court has always kind of been in question. He's at 29% on threes, and if he can't punish teams for going under on the pick and roll, it really mitigates a lot of the value of his quickness. And even he can't even punish guys from going under on the pick and roll from 2-point range because he's only at 32% from beyond 16 feet on 2-pointers. And then at the rim as well, he's only at 49% there, and he's really has to get some craftier moves. He's still, I've said this about him before, he's basically his only move right now is a speed layup. Maybe he's got a little bit of a floater, but you know, you don't see any kind of double pump, any kind of craft, any kind of going high off the window, you know, that type of stuff. And I think he really needs to put in some practice on that rather than just, all right, I'm going to go 1,000 miles an hour and try and beat the guy to the rim, because especially when you don't have a ton of spacing, which they have less of this year without Pero Antic on that second unit, then he's not going to be able to get those layups in if the defense is there.
Yeah, and it's not like I think a little bit, just as somebody who's been a defender of him for such a long time, I think about, oh, well, what would he do if he was with the starters? But it is true that the way that the Hawks manage the rotation, it's not like he's playing with a hockey sub second unit.
Right, yeah, I think he's probably spends about half of his minutes. You know, he'll usually play in a stint from, you know, middle of the first quarter or third quarter to middle of the second or fourth quarter. And the way the Hawks manage things, which I think is great, is they bring back Korver and Horford to play some of those minutes right around the break between the quarters. And so, you know, he does actually have a pretty high net rating, but I think a lot of that is due to the fact that he's playing with Korver and Horford, and certainly, you know, 25% usage rate and, you know, under 50% true shooting, not too great for this team.
Yeah, especially when you're not like an elite passer or something. Like there are trade-offs you could do to make that more palatable, but he doesn't really have those. One thing I wanted to mention before we moved on, I dug this out but forgot to mention it when we were talking about Splitter. Horford and Splitter, which was a combination that I really liked conceptually because it takes a little bit of the strain off Horford, they've only played 66 minutes together, but in those 66 minutes, again, small sample size, they've had a net rating of a positive 17.6, which is very good. It's actually one of the better ones for any two-man combination for the Hawks. So that's something that I think it's not going to be great against every Eastern Conference team, but it's another reason that I really like that move.
Yeah. So, Danny, you play fantasy football, just regular season-long fantasy football?
I do.
And I do as well. And although I love basketball, I'm kind of going to be missing my fix for fantasy football. But one of the things that I've really been enjoying this year, and you know, I haven't watched as much football because you know I'm a full-time basketball analyst, so I have to do that now, is just watching basketball games. Basically, the way the league has staggered a lot of the start times on Sunday, you could basically watch hours of basketball. And especially once the NFL is over, that would be a great way to do a day of DraftKings.com. They are one of our inaugural sponsors, the destination for daily fantasy basketball. And the beauty of it is you don't have to do it for the entire season. You just pick a day. And a day like that on Sunday, you know, use it as your replacement. Get together with some buddies, watch the games. You could all get into a league together, or you can play against people who are all around the country. You know, it's free to play. You've got nothing to lose. You can either play for money, you can play with your friends, whatever you want to do, but it's not fantasy as usual, it's DraftKings. So use the promo code CAPSPACE, that's all one word, at DraftKings now, and you can play for free with your first deposit. That also lets them know that you came from us, support the show. They will hopefully continue advertising with us, which means the show stays on the air. All of those things are good, everybody wins, hopefully you included, if you go to DraftKings.com now and use that promo code CAPSPACE.
And one of the teams that was probably challenging in terms of DraftKings is the Boston Celtics, because they have so much depth that they have to manage. They can manage their minutes a little bit differently.
Yeah, I guess that's true. That's an excellent segue, although I will not profess to be in any way a fantasy basketball expert. So I always feel bad when people tweet me about that. And
I wanted to make that disclaimer too. I get asked about fantasy a lot, and while I am in a league this year for the first time in a while, I am admittedly terrible at fantasy basketball. But I would like to get better. But I'm not. My insight is not particularly valuable to you. So I will tell you that if you ask me something, I will say I am sorry. I'm not the person to ask. And if somebody tells me if there's somebody that's a really good person to ask about that, I will refer if there's somebody who's worth referring to.
Yeah, so Boston, they've been a real weird team, 11-9, 4-2 since our last 30-60 about 2 weeks ago. And it seems like every game they play, they either blow out the opponent or they get blown out up until that game against San Antonio last night, which they almost won. Marcus Smart has been out. They have managed to keep the ship afloat without him. I mean, what's just your general feeling about this team right now as far as where they fall into the East hierarchy?
Well, I think right now they're benefiting a little bit from that kind of being that effort team. I mean, the forced turnover rate is still insane. It's a little bit lower than it was. It's at 18.8 now, which is still really, really high, tops in the league. And they're a good defensive team, which is really surprising. But I think I still feel the same way about them that I did at the beginning of the season, which was that they're a team that I'm confident is going to make the playoffs, and I'm also incredibly confident that is going to lose in the first round. That's just the way that I see them as having a ceiling, which I think is a very respectable ceiling, but their talent does not really condense well. And while I like a lot of their guys, I have trouble seeing how, let's say they faced Miami in a 7-game series, you know, like Miami is a flawed team, of course, but I have trouble seeing how this Celtics team like gets enough points reliably. They'd have to just kill in transition.
You know, my impression is the same as yours because, you know, it seems like they just have a lot of depth. Their second unit has been instrumental in their success. Although some of their starters have some of the best net ratings on the team.
True.
So that might be a little bit unfair. And also, I mean, other than Cleveland, I don't see any of these East teams as really being so formidable. I mean, I might make them favorites against Boston, but I wouldn't say that Boston can't beat anybody other than Cleveland.
That's a great point.
If they were matched up against them in the first round.
Yeah, favorite's probably a good way of putting it. Yeah, you're not trusting the juggernaut that is the Washington Wizards.
Well, yeah, if they even make the playoffs, I mean, they are they're in what 12th place in the conference right now.
We'll talk about them later because I saw them in person this week. But yeah, I mean, you're right that one of the more fascinating parts of this is while some teams are outperforming expectations, like the Pacers and a couple other teams, nobody is looking to be that really to me to being that really dominant team, and. I still like Isaiah. I've liked him for a long time, but I don't know exactly what his ideal role is on a, let's say on a conference finals team.
Yeah. I mean, because you're saying having him as a starting point guard, you know, I'm not sure whether he will continue to start when Smart comes back, and it may actually be Smart coming off the bench since Avery Bradley has been playing so well and shooting so well himself, especially since Smart has been out. But Isaiah did really struggle in the playoffs last year. He just kind of seems like someone who will regress in the playoffs. Number one, because you can really target him defensively. And just, you know, I think he competes reasonably hard, but he's too short to get closeouts. He's going to be attacked in the post. You can't really switch with him effectively. So those are all big concerns. And then I think also when you put a guy who's really has some length, I mean, Shumpert really, really gave him problems last year as well, and both Smart and Bradley are guys who aren't going to post up or anything. You know, you can put your point guard on them if you want to put your shooting guard on Isaiah. So it remains to be seen whether he can be effective in the playoffs. I do think this is a team that might have trouble scoring in kind of that playoff crucible. You know, they probably won't get as many turnovers as well against good teams in the playoffs, but I'm not ready to say any of these other teams are unbeatable. One more thing before we move on. Pretty much every player on this team with over 250 minutes played has a positive net rating. Would you care to guess the one who does not?
This is a trap, isn't it? I mean, it has to be.
Only fitting since Star Wars is coming out.
I assume it's David Lee.
You assume correctly.
Yeah.
And he has like a negative like 3 net rating or something too. Like it's He's starting to get phased out. I do give them credit for moving with the guys who, you know, the team has played well with them on the floor.
Is that one of the harder to justify trades in not like the worst trades, but just hard to justify considering the amount of money and opportunity cost on that and that they didn't squeeze anything out of the Warriors for it?
Well, it wasn't really very – I mean, when you say opportunity cost, I don't think it really was any opportunity cost.
Well, yeah, I guess they could have gotten a different player, like maybe a 2 or a 3 who, but yeah, I'm not sure there really was any guy like that, like a digitally.
Yeah, because if you remember, they did that deal basically last. Once they were over the cap, then they just traded, you know, the $10 million of Wallace and Chris Babb to get Lee. So it's not like they used, you know, they gave up $5 million in cap space. It was all after everything was done.
Correct. That's true. Yeah, so I guess it was.
But
it
that
was
said,
was.
I mean, you know, on an asset-for-asset basis, I mean, Lee, you could say, they would have a chance to help them, and Wallace wouldn't. But I think from a chemistry standpoint, from the fact that you're taking minutes away from guys like Olynyk, even a guy like Zeller, who I think is probably a better player than Lee at this point, and then also just the fact that maybe, you know, you didn't get a single asset out of the Warriors, yeah, that is a little bit disheartening.
Because at least the Sixers got a swap that they're not going to get the benefit of, it looks like, because unless the Warriors start losing games for some reason.
Yeah, they will not be getting the benefit of that.
Are you ready to move on to the Nets?
Indeed.
Okay, so the Nets are 5-15. They are 2-4, but they've had, you know, they've had a couple of good performances in that. I think they did reasonably well today. We're recording this on Sunday against the Warriors.
Yeah, so, I mean, what did they start? They started 0-9? I want to say.
Yeah, I think it was 0-9. So it might have been 0-10.
Yeah, so they're 5-6 since then. I mean, I think they've actually been playing, you know, pretty close to 500 ball. I don't expect that pace to continue, but, you know, I think they can kind of get to being, you know, a 25-30 win team. I don't see them as being just so bad. I could see them finishing ahead of quite a few of those teams in the West. But, I mean, I guess the one nice thing about this season so far that I haven't really thought about is, like, nobody's gotten injured yet, really.
For them?
Like, nobody. We haven't had, like, a big star miss much time. Like, I think Kevin's hamstring is the only one I could think of.
Oh, you're just trying to jinx the Nets, aren't you? I mean, good Lord. I mean, that team's just, like, an injury waiting to happen.
Well, no. What I'm saying, well, I mean, they barely even have a star on there who's big enough to count. Maybe you could say Lopez.
I would say Brooke.
No, the point I was kind of making is, at some point soon, like, some of these teams are going to start. I mean, it seems like almost everyone is playing well enough, is like playing better than expectations, except for like a few major teams. So, but there's going to be some teams that are going to suffer a big injury and,
you're right,
yeah, you know, just kind of drop out of it and really get down there.
Like the Pacers last year.
Yeah. And I do think the Nuggets too are going to get, I mean, I think the Nuggets will finish with a worse record than the Nets.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I was actually, I had a point of discussion on that, but we'll wait till then. But yeah, I think that the Nets, to me, they're like a 40% team, like, and there's that's fine. I mean, that I of course they wish they were better than that, but that was the consequence, justifiable consequence of, you know, shedding Derek Williams's money, is that they were gonna have that because they have Shane Larkin looked pretty good today. He's looked all right in the games that I've seen with them, but you know, you're not gonna get that kind of offensive engine from Jarrett Jack and Shane Larkin, and they don't have other guys. If Joe Johnson had a time machine, who's 5 years ago Joe Johnson, then that would help. But that's just not really who they are.
Joe Johnson is looking, I mean, we saw him today. Every game I've seen him so far, he has looked like he just has no juice left. Like, he really cannot get off the ground.
Yeah, I've wondered whether he would look better against second units. Like, if he just, would that be enough? And
I don't think he would, frankly.
That's what I thought today too. Like, because the Warriors bounced around their guys a lot, and like, he was, I think they had Rush on him a fair amount early, and he wasn't beating Brandon Rush.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that was a little disconcerting about him is he was, even in the first half especially, was getting to his spots in the post for his floater, but he just wasn't able to rise up. And ended up being way short on a shot where normally, even as recently as, you know, a year and a half ago in the playoffs against the Raptors, he dominated the Raptors. He dominated smaller defenders. And now it's at the point where you're not worried about, oh, Joe Johnson's going to dominate us. You know, we can't put a smaller defender on him, sort of thing. And then just his legs, even on his shots in transition. He looked like he was struggling to get his legs under him to rise up. And, you know, maybe he'll kind of work his way back into it. He does look a little bit heavier than in years past. But I think until further notice, I'm kind of saying he's about to end his PR is under 10. I'm not sure that he adds much as a basketball player at this point.
And that also makes it harder to trade Bogdanović because you just don't have enough dudes. And assuming you're not going to trade Bogdanović for a guy who's going to contribute more right now, because why would anybody make that trade? So you're kind of sacrificing a little bit there. But yeah, one other guy, I mentioned him a little bit, but Shane Larkin's done well. I like him, and I think he's another example of why declining rookie option years is just kind of a bad idea.
Yeah, that's something that I really just did not quite get from the Nets from the Knicks when they traded for him. And I mean, he was making like $1 million a year, right? Like, what's the opportunity cost there? You might as well see if the guy turns into something, especially in this cap environment. And you know, I think he's looking like someone who can ultimately be a solid backup point guard. It's ironic, actually. You know, I think he has a lot of the same skills that JJ Barea has, and if he had stayed in Dallas, I mean, not that Dallas shouldn't have traded him away because they got Tyson Chandler. That was a great deal for them, and they shed Calderon's money as well. But he's got a 17 PR. He's shooting 50% on threes. Obviously, that's not going to sustain, but he's a guy who shot well on threes in college. You know, his shot looks pure. He's shooting 44% on twos outside of 16 feet as well. So I think he's a guy who, you know, at the very least can be able to shoot the three. Shoots it okay off the dribble if you go under on him. And he's got some speed. I mean, he doesn't finish great at the rim. He's kind of got the same problem as Schroeder, but he doesn't have Schroeder's long arms either. He's even shorter than Schroeder. But, you know, on a team that has a little more spacing than the Nets' second unit, where he's playing with guys like Thomas Robinson, you know, he could have a little more space to maneuver there. So I think, you know, he's a guy who could settle in long-term as a solid backup. I mean, he doesn't really have the size to be a starter, but he does have a lot of quickness and athleticism. So I think he's at least a small success story for the Nets, and given how what their financial situation was, the fact they were able to get him for this year for that amount of money was good. Unfortunately, you know, he's not going to be under contract past this year, and they will have to use cap space to retain him, so it may not really last.
Yeah, they have I was just looking at their schedule. They have a really interesting set the rest of this month because they face a lot of Eastern Conference teams that have kind of been outperforming expectations. They play the Heat twice, the Magic twice, Pacers, and teams like that. So if they can pull out a couple of those games, that would be really a really big help for them because they only have a couple of games against the real cellar dwellers, whoever we classify those as being.
The Charlotte Hornets, this team might be like pretty good. Do you think this team is going to make the playoffs now? They've shown a lot. I mean, we're 20 games in. They have a better net rating than Cleveland. They have a better net rating than Toronto. They have a better net rating than the Hawks. 3.7.
I think that they're on the fringe, but I think they're on the positive side of the fringe right now. So I think I'd say they're more likely than not, but maybe not a ton by that. But I've been very impressed with them this year. I think that their pieces, obviously they're missing Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. That's obvious. Don't need to go too much into that. But they're not spacing death anymore, and that's really important. And they're also not playing Lance Stephenson anymore, which is an additional help. And their offense just looks better now, and they actually have a capable second unit.
Yeah, they do. I mean, they've been getting really good production. You've got good ratings from Lynn, Lamb, even Kaminsky, all those guys very much in the green in terms of their net rating. Lamb, obviously, we've talked about him on past programs, that his shooting is going to go down a little bit, but you know, I think we can count on him at least being, you know, a solid bench guy. Kaminsky, I think, is someone who, when he finds his footing, can come on a little bit. I'd like to just see him shooting more threes, even if they're harder shots, because he just has that level of touch as a shooter. And, you know, less of this put it on the floor with, like, the slow drive. So, you know, Lynn, I mean, he shouldn't be starting or anything like that, but he's closed some games playing at the two, and that versatility to play at the two has helped with some of the injuries that they've had on the wing, allowing Marvin Williams to play the four, where he has actually been extremely effective this year. I mean, he's one of the great feel-good stories of this year, given where he was these last couple of years, to be as effective as he's been.
Yeah, one thing that I thought was really, really fascinating with them is right now they're tied for fourth in offensive efficiency at 103.9, which is
completely insane. Now, granted, you know, they're probably, you know, like 10 other teams that are within like a point of them or something.
But what I find amazing about that is that last year, that same number would put a team 13th in the league. And some of that is that teams generally, they can have a rough start to the year. But I just thought the gap of the same number being fourth and 13th is kind of impressive.
Yeah, that is surprising. And same thing defensively, obviously. The Warriors are defending at pretty much the same rate as they did last year when they were number one in the league by, I think, like about a point and a half per 100 possessions. But there are just a lot of teams that have been better so far this year, which is kind of funny when you consider more teams are trying to shoot threes and play with more pace, and you would think it'd be, and play small, you'd think it would be more of an offensive focus of the league. But as you noted, teams do tend to get better over the course of the season by about, you know, maybe like, like 2 points per 100 from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. So I think we will see teams start to play better, but it also puts into stark relief what Golden State is doing, how good they have been at a time when, and even Curry usually starts off the year not that well and gets better. The fact that they've been doing so well when the rest of the league is doing so poorly, I mean, this is looking like one of the greatest offenses ever right now, and, you know, obviously one of the greatest teams ever too, but we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Sorry, Charlotte, we somehow turned this into the Warriors when we're going to talk about the Warriors in a couple minutes.
One thing I did want to say about Charlotte, though, Spencer Hawes had a very nice game against the Bulls. We always malign him on this program, and he had a very efficient game, was key in their 102-96 win over the Bulls on Saturday night. Speaking about those Bulls, a few interesting tidbits. I mean, one, not so interesting, but Mike Dunleavy being out another 4 to 6 weeks, basically before he can even start on-court activity. This is another kind of small foible here for the Bulls. One of them was Aaron Brooks going back into the Phoenix game and then missing 2 weeks. You know, I've never heard of great after he injured his hamstring, went back in, and then injured it worse, so he had to miss 2 weeks. You know, Dunleavy was, the team said 8 to 10 weeks initially, when he was interviewed on Media Day, was basically like, yeah, I'm hoping to play this season. He had a microdiscectomy, basically, I guess, had like part of the disc in his spine removed. I don't know much more about it than that. So then, you know, as that 8 to 10 weeks started, he starts ramping up his activity again. And right about that 10 weeks, he has a setback, goes to see two specialists, and we find out what he has to do is rehab for another 4 to 6 weeks. And then after that point, he could even start trying to do on-court stuff again. So it really seems to me it's going to be, I would guess, at least 2 more months at the earliest before we see him in a Bulls uniform on the court.
And you have to start thinking about that as a need. I mean, obviously they've had better production from McDermott and Snell, I think, than maybe somebody like me expected, but this is a team that has a lot of front court depth, and that would be a potential use of it if they were willing to make a decision on those guys in the near term, because now there's a much greater incentive there.
Yeah, it's interesting, although, you know, Taj Gibson is another guy who I think has kind of regressed from last year offensively. He used to have some success scoring in the post even as recently as last year against second unit guys. He has not really been too successful at that this year. And he also, you know, his mid-range jumper hasn't been fantastic, not getting on the offensive glass as much as he once did. Definitely looks noticeably less athletic at age 30 coming off that ankle surgery. That's just kind of what happens. The other Bulls note I have is that this team isn't shooting any threes. They're shooting at a decent percentage, but just, you know, they've been in the teens pretty much every game, and which is odd considering that in the preseason they had games where they're shooting 35 threes, 39 threes, something like that. We were all heralding a new era, and then as the regular season has started, that hasn't been the case. Pau Gasol, I was able to corner him for just one question after the game on Wednesday against the Nuggets. So I asked him, you know, he shot threes in the preseason, how come you're not shooting any now? And he said, you know, he knew his exact stats. He said, I was 4 for 8 in the preseason in 5 games, and now in the regular season I'm 0 for 7, and, you know, I think I've been effective inside, and, you know, if I were making some of them, I'd take more. So he was very aware of the issue. Maybe he'd been asked about it before, but he knew his exact stats. I mean, and, you know, it's funny, especially more veteran guys like him, they know all this stuff, right? Like they, the things that we, I mean, maybe you could say there are a few guys who don't, but especially a guy like him who's a smart player, all the things that we carp about, I mean, they think about that stuff, you know, five times as much as any of us do. And just the awareness he had of that question to just like snap off what his stats were, like that was a very good reminder of that fact.
A non sequitur, but related to Powell, did you see the Twitter exchange between Dirk and Powell this weekend?
Yeah, that was fantastic.
It was absolutely perfect.
What did Powell say back to him to remind everyone what happened there?
So basically what happened was Powell, I believe it was his 1,000th or was it 2,000th regular season game? I think it was his 1,000th.
I think it was 1,000.
So he was playing his 1,000th regular season game. Congratulations, Powell. And so he tweeted out something like the celebrating that. And so if people want to post their favorite, you know, their favorite regular season moments, they can do that. So Dirk Nowitzki posts he links to a YouTube video, not of him dunking on Pau Gasol, but of Vucevic dunking on Pau Gasol.
Oh, yeah, when he just destroyed him with the left last year?
Yeah, and then Pau basically just said, like, LOL, you got me, which was just the good humor that you would expect from Pau Gasol. But it was one of those interactions. It kind of reminds me of what Rudy Gobert does with Twitter, of like, if I were an athlete who was just having fun with Twitter, of what I would want to do with it. And you can tell those guys have a good relationship.
Yeah, actually, I always heard that those guys like didn't like each other that much.
Really?
Maybe
it's just that Powell is such a nice guy that he's going to take anything with good humor. That's also possible.
Yeah. Cleveland 13-7, 2-4 since we last checked in with them. And you know, I think they're actually, this is not too surprising to me. I thought that the way they started the year was actually more surprising given what some of their health issues are.
I think that's true, and I mean, and their loss, their most recent loss was to Miami when LeBron didn't play. So I think that's a little bit different. But yeah, I think that they're in this spot where they're becoming closer, to use the Danny Green phrase, they kind of are who we thought they were at this stage. And one of the things that I looked at was their defense was ridiculous at the beginning of the year, but now they're kind of stepping back into it. And two big things that I think are important to note is right now they're dead middle of the pack in opponent effective field goal percentage. So that's one way of calibrating, you know. So that means that teams are making, you know, they're making shots at a reasonable rate against them. And then the other one, which is something that I've followed with a lot of teams, is that they're six from the bottom in forcing turnovers. And when you are as successful as this team is at full strength, particularly in transition, that is something that would help them on both ends. But they don't really have the personnel for it at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, especially without Shumpert, there's no one on this team you look at as like a guy who has quick hands, or, you know, maybe LeBron if he's really locked in. But that's
or Dellavedova if he's just like free checking guys and they're not calling fouls.
Yeah, and they did put Delly into the starting lineup. I would imagine the idea being to help the defense and maybe get a little more firepower on the second unit with Mo Williams, who has been scoring very effectively, but never known for his defense. Also, Mozgov, you know, has not been closing games. He hasn't been playing very much. He has talked about how his knee is still not really right. And, you know, whatever he had done, it's really quite a long recovery time since he had the surgery back in, like, July or something. So, minor as that surgery supposedly was, he clearly is not quite back yet. I mean, I think hopefully he will get there, especially for himself, being that he is a free agent. And Kyrie obviously coming back will help the offense. I don't think that'll do a ton for the defense. Shumpert coming back will help the defense. And at least this is a team that's always going to do really well in the defensive glass. They're a great rebounding team. So they have that going for their defense. But I think at least in a regular season setting, I don't see this team as being a top 10 defense, especially when you have Love out there. The question is whether they can get to that level in the playoffs.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. And I think it's more likely than some people do. But one of the other things with that is that one of the games that happened during this span was that the Wizards went super small against them. And granted, part of it was, of course, that Mozgov isn't right. They basically forced him and, to a larger degree, Kevin Love out of the game, because something we've seen with Blatt is that he's very comfortable sitting those guys if he doesn't like the matchup for his team.
Yeah, that was the one loss in this stretch. I mean, because the rest of them have kind of been closed, and they lost on the road at New Orleans, who's been playing better. They lost at Miami. LeBron was out. The rest of the games have kind of been closer. And they did actually only beat the Nets, I think, on a last second shot by LeBron too in this stretch, but they actually got blown out at home by the Wizards by like 15 points and had really had a lot of difficulty stopping them. That small lineup worked against them. So, I mean, I'm not concerned. I'm never going to be concerned on this team until they're healthy and not playing well. But yeah, it's, I think this, you know, kind of poking along at this kind of 600 type of pace is more what we should expect for them until Kyrie and Shump are, and Mozgov are really back in the swing of things.
I definitely think that's fair. Dallas, still a surprise story. They've kind of toned down the ridiculousness a little bit. They're 12-9, 3-3 since the last time we recorded about this.
Yeah, and the one guy I wanted to talk about the most on them is Wes Matthews. He broke out with 36 points and 10 threes against the Wizards on Sunday. The Wizards really were not defending him effectively because they didn't close out him and they weren't running him off the line. When they did, finally, towards the end, he was actually able to make a couple of plays. But he does offensively look much slower than he did last year. He definitely looks like he is lacking the lift that he had in previous times. And you know, when I did my piece last week on guys coming back from injuries, I put some GIFs in there to show where it was missing. Like, for example, his post game used to be fantastic, right? And for teams, when he was playing with Damian Lillard, that would try to cross match and put a wing onto Lillard, then he would take the point guard down in the post and just abuse him. Now, he doesn't have the strength to really back down and stay on balance the way he used to be able to on his few post attempts. When he tries to get in the lane and do like a hook shot or something, he can't really explode, and he's not getting the lift on his turnaround jumper. Now, my other conclusion, which hopefully is starting to be borne out, was that because he kind of shoots a set shot from three, the lack of legs wouldn't really bother him as much in that respect because, you know, he's not really jumping. I mean, you still use your legs, they're important, but you're not trying to really explode, at least with the way he shoots. And I thought that that was something that was going to improve. And, you know, when you hit 10 threes, I guess you could say that it's going to. And I think also, though, you might see games where his shooting waxes and wanes based on the amount of rest, how he's kind of feeling that day. I mean, when you come back from injury, you kind of have good days and bad. And I think that's something that he's going through as well.
And also, Rick Carlisle, I saw today that Rick Carlisle mentioned that Chandler Parsons has expressed a willingness to come off the bench, I think, particularly while he's kind of coming back from all this stuff. And I think that is a could be a really useful thing for them just to get the rotations in line and to allow him to be a part more of finishing lineups.
Denver is 8-13, 2-4 since we last recorded, at least this podcast. I saw them in person against the Bulls on Wednesday, and I just have no idea how they're even as good as they are, especially with some of the injuries that they've had. And then they won. They almost beat the Bulls. They won at Toronto, I think the next night. And then they beat the Sixers, right? So they really, to go 2-1 over that stretch of games with the team that they have is absolutely remarkable.
I've been really impressed with Mike Malone just generally, but like with this team that I think they're playing well. They're just not nearly as good as their record, and that to me is a sign of good coaching. And also, they've been doing this without Nurkic, who I think many of us, including myself, expected that if he were fully healthy, would be their best player.
And talking to some of the people around the team, that was the feeling there as well. I don't know about being their best player, but that he was a guy that they're really missing. And they've gone to starting Nikola Jokic, and Mike Malone was clear that he had earned that spot, but unfortunately against certain matchups, he's just doesn't have the athleticism or the experience. Pau Gasol completely destroyed the Nuggets, and Jokic had no chance against him in the post whatsoever. Malone actually... Denver was down by like 10, and he actually went to J.J. Hickson and didn't start Jokic in the second half. And Denver actually played pretty well until the very end, partially as a result of that move. So Jokic, I think he's got some real skills offensively. He doesn't screw up too badly, but he doesn't have much juice protecting the rim. You know, Denver doesn't really have anybody like that. Frankly, you know, Nurkic maybe can help with that a little bit. But... I think Jokic is someone who, if he could just speed up his release a little bit, that could really help him improve for next year.
One other thing that we should talk about without, you know, before moving on with the Nuggets is Emmanuel Mudiay. I'm not particularly concerned because he's a teenage point guard, but, I mean, what he's doing is actually remarkable in its own way.
Yeah, I mean, he's having really one of the worst seasons in NBA history right now from any sort of objective statistical standpoint. You know, I predicted that he was going to really struggle from two-point range this year, but, you know, I thought he could kind of keep it close to 40%. He's now shooting 31% from the field and has really had some games where he just kind of looked overmatched. But, yeah, I mean, the usage percentage he has, I mean, his is like 28% the last time I checked, which is, that includes assists. I mean, there's a usage rate, which includes assists, and a usage percentage. So his usage rate, including assists, was 28%, which is basically Kobe-esque for the efficiency that he's had. Part of the problem is they don't really have anyone else on this team other than Gallo who can create a shot. So he's had a very, very large role thrust onto his shoulders. And I think he is competing well defensively. I think he's getting to where he can create shots. He's turning the ball over a ton. So, yeah, I'm not worried about him ultimately, but the facts are that he's having just an incredibly bad season so far, objectively.
Yeah, long term, though, does that? I mean, obviously it's more concerning than him doing like what Porzingis is doing, but I'm generally okay with it.
Well, I'm a lot less okay with it than if he had been, you know, actually scoring at like a semi-passable rate. So, I mean, there is some cause for concern, but, you know, a lot of what he's doing, it's not like he's just bricking open shots. Like, he takes, on any team, there's going to be a guy who takes hard shots. And Gallo does that a little bit, but he's somewhat limited in the amount that he can create. You know, he's not really a guy who's going to get in pick and roll. And so someone's got to run the pick and rolls on this team, and it's going to be him. And, you know, teams are giving him the shot, and he's just shooting it. And a lot of them are pretty difficult attempts where he's off balance. He's, you know, got a body. I think especially at the rim, he has the athleticism to where he can get much better at those. He's only shooting 48% even within 3 feet, and he's getting there for 25% of his shots. So, yeah, I mean, I think – And he's just been miserable. 3 to 10 feet, he's only shooting 25%. 10 to 16, only 26%. Those are numbers that are really going to increase, even if you don't ever believe that he's going to be a passable long range shooter. So, I mean, just from watching him, so much of it is because of his role on the team and a role that he frankly has to play on this team that it's less worrisome than if he were just gunning away and really hurting the team in a way, you know, selfishly.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think that having somebody who's capable of slotting him down in the rotation would do a lot. And I think they're going to be in position to do that because this is a team that there's a lot of latitude right now to, if they can get like the third worst record or something like that, that to get somebody who will be useful.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, I think we probably both think that the Knicks are not going to make the playoffs, and you know, while it looks like Denver will finish with a worse record than the Knicks, they do get to throw the Knicks lottery balls essentially in there as well. So they get to increase their chance to number one pick by having that swap right with the Knicks, even if they don't finish with a worse record than the Knicks do. So that helps a little bit. Yeah, all right, you want to move on to next in line here?
Sure. Detroit Pistons, they're 12-9, 5-2 since the last 30-60. And what's notable to me is that they're doing it without being, they're a bottom 10 defense right now.
They're a bottom 10 defense?
Last I saw, they were 21st in defensive efficiency. Let me see if that's still right. Yep, they're 21st in defensive efficiency right now. Giving up. Oh, nope, that's last season. I'm an idiot. They are 8th. That's what I like. It was one of those things.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, there's no way.
This is a great example of when you think something is wrong, don't say it until you've looked to make sure that it's.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, because in this offense is definitely not good. Now, they can't shoot at all. I think they're in the bottom 5 in e-field goal percentage. They, surprisingly, despite the fact they have Drummond, they never get to the line. And a fair amount of those are semi-intentional fouls of Drummond. And so, of course, they don't really convert their free throws because of him either. But they never turn the ball over.
Yep.
And they also are great offensive rebounding. So those two things, I mean, I think turning it over, maybe it's encouraging from a young team that they are not turning it over that much. The offensive rebounding is something that you can kind of rely on every night against most teams. So, you know, it's tough to just completely shut this team down due to the offensive rebounding. Like, that's nice. But in a kind of greater sense, I mean, let's assume that they're not really going to add a ton to this team. I mean, they are going to have up to about $28 million in cap space, depending on what they do with Ilyasova, who I think at this the way he's playing, they should just keep his contract for $8.4 million. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with it right now. I mean, it's not like you're sitting there going, oh, my God.
And he's the only guy on this team who can make a shot.
Yeah, it's not like you're sitting there going, oh, we need that money for Al Horford. I mean, I don't think they're getting Al Horford. Probably.
No, I agree with you there. But, you know, let's say they get, you know, some decent depth pieces so their bench isn't terrible next year with that money. What do you think is the ceiling for this core? If they keep it together, everyone kind of grows into what we hope they can be. You know, I don't see this as a championship contender. Do you agree with that?
I do. I think they could be a conference finals team. I mean, you're looking at, I think you're looking at something similar, not similar meaning like they'll succeed in the same way, but I think of something like what Memphis has done where they're in the mix a lot, but they're probably not going to win a title. And that's good. I mean, I think that would be an amazing step for this team.
Yeah, especially with them mired in such a morass since really 2009 was their last time in the playoffs. I think Drummond is a guy, I don't know that he has that much better to get. I don't believe in him really ever being an amazingly skilled guy.
Especially with rebounding not being something that ages well. You know, rebounding
exactly,
is generally
yeah. I mean,
something
I think
that peaks early.
He, you know, at 22, 23 right now, he's basically in his athletic prime. And, you know, with the energy that he has, the minutes he's playing, I don't think he's going to be able to, you know, you don't see guys who are 30 years old getting, you know, 18% offensive rebounds or whatever it is, whatever crazy number is that he's getting right now. So I think he can get a lot better defensively. So I think this is a team that with some of the personnel they have and the coaching could get into being consistently a top five defense in the league if everything breaks right, if Drummond continues to develop his defense. So, but let's talk about kind of what they could ultimately be offensively. To me, I think the question is how good are KCP and Stanley Johnson going to get? Because I think, you know, Drummond and Reggie Jackson, I think we kind of have a pretty decent idea of what those guys are. Jackson's 25 already now.
Yeah, I think that Stanley Johnson could, especially if he can stick at the four, I think he could be a really fun piece to kind of bounce between those two positions, the two forward positions defensively. I think he'll be able to hit enough shots, and what I really like about him is that he's more capable kind of handling the ball, being more of a secondary, tertiary guy who can kind of create in opportunities. Like, you don't want him running stuff, but that he can, if he gets the ball in his hands and has a guy closing out on him, he can do more things than just, you know, pop a shot or something. And KCP, I mean, it's kind of crazy because we saw, I think, inarguably his best defensive game of the year, maybe of his professional career.
He's shut down quite a few guys, actually.
Yeah, but in terms of a singular performance, I mean, because he that's still the best defense I think anybody's played on Curry this year.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, I'm sort of, if we take the defensive improvement as a given, I think also, you know, the ability to have Johnson at the four, switch a lot, like all that I'm kind of pricing into the idea of them potentially being a consistent top five defense. I think, but offensively, both Johnson and KCP are guys who theoretically could be guys who could handle in a secondary pick and roll and, you know, hopefully shoot, you know, and, are, you know, so are they going to really be able to do that and make decisions, finish at the basket on occasion? Are those guys going to end up as 35% three-point shooters? Or are they going to be like 38% three-point shooters, 39% three-point shooters? This team to really get to where, I mean, I still think even if all the guys reach their absolute potential, this still is not a championship contender. But to be even like, you know, a consistent 53-54 win team, that's what needs to happen is for those two guys to really evolve offensively. And we're probably still a couple of years away from that happening.
So a guy I was thinking about, obviously not in his current age and state, but I was thinking that, like, the guy you would want to put between Johnson and KCP would be somebody like a younger Gallinari, I think would be a nice little fit with them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, or I like the idea of just one other guy. I mean, I think Marcus Morris, if he were just a little bit better defensively, might be like a pretty solid fit there as well. And maybe I'm giving Marcus not enough credit defensively. I mean, this team has defended well with him playing a ton of minutes this year. But, yeah, I think, and, you know, he can guard threes credibly, maybe not twos. But, you know, certainly anything 3-4, you can kind of switch with him and Johnson eventually. Anyway, I don't know. I mean, is that sort of your thought, though, on what the ceiling is for this team? Is kind of like low 50s in wins consistently unless something big changes?
Yeah, I think low 50s. I think that you kind of put that as kind of like the expected value. And then with that, you can always have a year where you pop off to like 56, 57. I mean, that's, I think when you're a team that's in that low 50s range, that's always in the capability. And also, I think what they need to do, if they can get more depth, I think that's really important. But if they can be one of those teams that has guys that intrigue other franchises enough that if a team makes a mistake, like they have some, you know, if a team, not, I'm not trying to say DeMarcus Cousins, but like if the next James Harden trade happens, they don't have a ton of draft assets, but they have a ton of guys that a team could say, oh, well, they could be good players for us. And so just to be in the conversation for somebody like that might actually be the biggest way that they could make an impact.
Yeah. And what occurred to me initially is like, well, you know, that Orlando team, right? Like when Howard is about the same age that Drummond was now, 07-08, he kind of broke through low 50s in wins, ended up losing to the Pistons. Then the next year they broke through again and made it to the finals. But the difference between that team is that I think Howard at his peak has much more offensive potential than Drummond. You know, Howard was a guy who could score 30 points largely on post-ups, where I don't see Drummond being that sort of a player. I think his touch is even less than Dwight's was. I think Dwight's touch around the rim was kind of unfairly maligned because it wasn't necessarily pretty, but, you know, Dwight at least had like a pretty good left hand and, you know, a decent touch on his hook shots.
I would agree with that. And I also think that those teams had kind of a more realized version of the talent that Detroit hopes to have than what they have right now.
Yeah, I mean, you had guys like Rashard Lewis. You know, Detroit doesn't have a secondary scorer as good as he was, or even a secondary playmaker as good as Turkoglu was.
Yeah, I probably should have thought of him when I said Gallinari, but I think Gallinari is more the archetype, but Hedo would be a good enough fit too.
All right, let's get to the Warriors. We talk about them a ton, so just drop a few little nuggets on them, and I know you have some as well. One was a great one from Bill Simmons' podcast on Friday that I had been meaning to look up. Steph Curry is now averaging the second most points per minute of any player ever. The only season that was better was Wilt's 1961-62 season, that legendary season when he averaged 50.4 points a game. But number one, they were playing at a preposterous pace back then, too. Number two, he averaged over 48 minutes a game that season. He played every game, and including overtime games. So really, and he still basically was averaging, you know, almost just slightly over a point per minute. So if you adjust for pace, certainly this is the best, adjusted for pace, I'm almost certain, I didn't run the numbers, that this is the best scoring season on a pace adjusted basis ever by Steph. And then you throw in the efficiency as well.
And you throw in that he's passing the ball a lot. This isn't a guy who's just taking every shot that comes to him. He's still an important part of their offense in a distribution capacity, even though Draymond is doing his fair share too.
Yeah, let's be clear about this. Like, absolutely clear. If he keeps doing this for the entire season, and, you know, another game tonight, it was certainly totally on pace. You know, I forget whatever it was, like 29 points on 14 shots or something. Like, if he does this all season, it's the greatest regular season in NBA history. Like, hands down, no two ways about it, in my opinion.
And it's not like he's such a sieve defensively that you're sitting there going, oh, well, it's not counting all of that. I mean, he's doing well enough on that end, and the team is obviously...
Yeah, he's had some problems one-on-one at times, yeah. And especially because teams are seeking him out and and really trying to put him in as many pick and rolls as they can to wear him out. That's where his stamina is just so unbelievable. Like in that game today, they ran him in a pick and roll basically every time down in the third quarter. He was getting tired. Like Jarrett Jack was able to make some hay off of those pick and rolls. And Jack, you know, I think just knows him pretty well from their time together in Golden State. And so then Steph got going just with effort plays, getting out in transition, making cuts. Like the, you know, he had a great cut to the basket where Azili found him. I mean, and that I think is the difference between him and a lot of scorers is, you know, how many easy points does a guy like James Harden get by moving off the ball, right? He has to create everything. Steph gets all the stuff that he creates with the ball in his own hands, but then moves off the ball to get easy stuff as well. That's why, you know, he's such a threat no matter what he's doing. Anyway, all right, enough on Curry. I mean, obviously he's been unbelievable. A couple other notes that you had.
Sure. So one of the things we talked about a little bit before, which I think we both came to independently, is that the Warriors starters and just kind of on the aggregate, they're defending about as well as they did last year. So right now, so before today's game, they were averaging 96 points, or their opponents were averaging 96 points per 100 when Curry was on the floor, which is what I use as a proxy for the starters. The Warriors use a bunch of different lineups, but that's about as well as I can do. That was 97.2 last year, so it's pretty close. And then the biggest difference probably in terms of this team and last year's team, beyond Curry becoming what he's been so far this year, is Festus Ezeli has made them a capable offensive rebounding team. So they were 21st last year, bottom, the best of the bottom 10. They're fourth this year.
And really? They're that high? They're fourth?
They're fourth right now.
That's and I think it's really like it's mostly him.
Yeah.
One thing that I noted, we've been talking a lot about whether Bogut should start or Ezeli should start. Felt like Bogut should start just because, I mean, you have to sort of get 48 good minutes at center, and Bogut has to play some of those, and he is going to be much more effective with the starters. We've talked about why that is because of the shooting, and you know his DHO game will work much better with them. But Ezeli, both in running the floor, he's so much better in transition, like the times that he'll beat guys down the floor, like he has alley-oops in transition. Bogut, not really something he does that much. And not only will Bogut, is it a question of Bogut not running the floor to like actually beat guys down the floor, but on a lot of these transition opportunities, if he gets the rebound or if he inbounds the ball, he's just going to kind of walk it up. And then his man could basically double team Steph until he actually gets into the play. Like that's, you know, there are 3, 4, 5 possessions a game where that'll happen, and he'll kind of short circuit any kind of a transition opportunity by just kind of not getting down there with everyone else. I'm not even talking about beating everyone else down the floor. And then Ezeli has a 33.8% chase percentage on offensive rebounds. That's basically what percentage of offensive rebounds per Nylon Calculus and Seth do you get to, and that's unbelievable.
It is, and so to put it in context with the Warriors, so Festus is 7th of qualified players in offensive rebound rate, Spates is 30th, and Bogut is tied for 40th. So he is really the only guy that's in that kind of top tier. And yeah, I mean, and really when you think about the way that this team functions, that he can do that. And, you know, they have some guys who get the kind of the situational team offensive rebounds. But that is such a crazy dynamic because of how great, intuitively, I haven't looked at the numbers yet, but how it seems like they just kill on second chance opportunities.
Oh, yeah. Any time afterwards, I mean, yeah, we should look at this on NBA Wow, like their prior events tab. But yeah, when they get an offensive rebound, if Festus doesn't decide to try and post up again or dunk it, you know, it's going back out for a three. That's where Steph does so much damage. And so to be clear on what that chase percentage is, that's the number of times you get within 5 feet of an offensive rebound,
right,
basically. And so Ezeli does that twice as often as Bogut does, even though Bogut kind of gets a greater percentage of those. That's because, you know, it's the ones that are right around the rim when he's already there. He's not going out of his area to get offensive rebounds the way Ezeli is.
Ready to move on to the Pacers?
No, we're going to do the Houston Rockets.
Houston Rockets. Oh, we could have skipped them. Rockets 10-11, but they're 5-2 since the last time we recorded. So that's, maybe they just need to keep firing. Maybe they just need to keep firing Kevin McHale.
We're
playing inferior teams.
Yeah, I mean, so they're 5-2 over their last 7 games, but only a 1.4 differential over that time. And then they've had two crazy comebacks from down 15 points in the fourth during that period.
Yeah.
Do you think they make the playoffs?
I do. I think that when you one of the ways that I like to think about a team is, you know, is what they have already done, is that representative, better or worse than what I expect? And I think that they've been substantially worse than I would expect them to be for the rest of the season, just because I don't think the effort stuff can be any worse than it's been. And everything else, I think, is on the negative side as well. And their talent level is really high. I don't think they're going to get a particularly good seed, but I do think they're going to make it in.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they are 10-11, but they still have like a negative 4.9 differential or something is actually very lucky. They are, as bad as they played, they are lucky to be this good. I mean, they should really, if you consider those two 15 points down games just on their own, you know, they should be 8-13 instead of 10-11. Then we're thinking of them perhaps a lot differently. You know, I guess it depends kind of whether everyone else in the West gets their act together. I mean, I see them still. I'm not convinced that they're playing much better than like a 500 team so far, even on this streak. So, you know, I don't think the defense is there. Harden at least is playing better. Like, that's encouraging. And Timo is back now, maybe, which is nice for them. He actually played for the first time, I think, last night. So that helps as well. But until this team starts actually winning some games comfortably, I'm not really any higher on them than, you know, basically kind of 500. I still, you know, they've played this way throughout now 25% of the season.
Yeah, they're in this spot where, for me, like, when I watched the other teams, like, I watched the second half of Suns-Grizzlies today, and I just did not walk away from that game impressed with the Suns, and that's just kind of the way I've been with all the teams that are really around them, the Blazers, the Wolves, you know. They're all teams that there are things that I like, but they just haven't done it, and for me, like, you've talked about this with Kevin Pelton, and there's just a lot of things on it. For me, when we're in that kind of a situation where nobody's really impressed, I, in my own mind, defer to the team that I thought had the most talent. And yeah, they've horrendously underperformed to it. But so for right now, I get what you're saying, and I agree with you.
I will say this, too, in support of your point. That talent has looked better. I mean, we mentioned Harden. Dwight had a very spry game last night after sitting out on Friday, a game that they won anyway, even though he was out against the Mavericks. And even Lawson has had a few moments where he's looked like, you know, at least a contributor, if not kind of the semi-star point guard they were hoping he was going to be.
Yeah. Now are we ready to do the Pacers? After I pretend that the Rockets don't exist for another podcast?
Yes. The Pacers, 4.9 net rating. They are looking very, very good. And one of the big guys who I think should get credit for that, you know, with their defense being as good as it is Jan Mahimi, who this has been the year that he has really established himself as a legitimate starting center in this league.
He really has. And what I've always liked about him is that his rim protection kind of numbers have always looked pretty good, but there's always been the trade-off, and he is far from the only guy for that, where the reason that his numbers look good is because he doesn't play many minutes, because either they had Roy Hibbert above him or he gets in foul trouble, but those things are looking a little bit better this year.
Yeah, that's true. He's avoided foul trouble slightly. I think also that offensively, although he's never a guy, you know, he's kind of got stone hands. He'll shoot his jumper when he's wide open, but it's not really a shot you want to make a living off of if you're at the team level. But I think having more spacing has helped him be a little bit more effective offensively. I think that's true for a lot of guys who, you know, are not really like great operators, kind of need a while to get their shot off, don't have the greatest hands. You know, if you can play a four out system with those guys, then they can not hurt you quite as much offensively, and I think that's been the case with him.
Yeah, I've been impressed. And then the other guy, you talked about him again. I think credit goes to Candace Buckner, because I would never have thought of this, is that they're still playing well with LaVoy Allen.
Yeah, they are. He's regressed. I mean, he did have some crazy net rating, like plus 18. Now that's down to 8. So, I mean, and you know, LaVoy Allen is a nice player. I don't think he's a starting level player.
No, great.
I mean, and also, you know, I think part of the reason for that was because they had played some teams where they wanted to go big against early in the season. Now they've played more small. CJ Miles has been unbelievable.
Awesome.
By the way, I mean, he's sort of been, you know, David Locke, who knows this from the Utah days, is astonished at how much he's improved. I mean, and you remember back when I mean, let's think back to the summer of 2014, right? The Pacers were just in the conference finals. They offer Lance Stephenson a 5-year, $44 million deal. He turns that down. Now, they have to stay under the tax, and so they offered part of their middle exception to C.J. Miles, which he accepted. Another guy who was a role player on a bad team on the Cavs. That's sort of going to be one of my things now, I think, is that role players on bad teams are kind of underrated and maybe role players on good teams are overrated. And Miles, I think, was one of those guys. And so they offered him part of the mid-level exception. That basically, everyone was like, wow, why'd you do that? Like, that means that, basically now you can't bring Lance back without going over the tax. They pulled the offer to Lance. And wow, like, how much better are they because they have C.J. Miles than Lance Stephenson?
Yeah, and that is also why it's good to trust the team that's had a guy with talent evaluation. They had that. And Miles has been such a huge part of their success. I mean, he hits his jump shots. He doesn't...
Yeah, he's been playing the four, and he's also, I mean, like, they're guard... Like, a lot of teams are guarding him with fours. And,
right.
That's why we talked about, yeah, it's not so much... Paul George is playing the four. It's that you are playing two small forwards at the forward spots, and then they have to put their best wing defender on George, and now you're going to, you can't have, your four-man guard George Hill or Monte Ellis, so now he's on C.J. Miles, and C.J. Miles goes nuts like he did against Myers Leonard in the game against Portland the other night.
Yeah, it is a really kind of interesting thing just in terms of the way you think about how you defend a team, and that a lot of those spillover benefits do go to C.J. Miles, which is what we expected, and he's held his own defensively, which I think is another important part. Like, you think about what you want from a role player, particularly a role player who starts, is somebody who does something well that other teams have to pay attention to and takes away from the other spots as minimally as possible. This is actually something that Oklahoma City has been looking for in their two guard forever and hasn't really found. And Miles, yeah, I think, does a great job of that.
Yeah, and Miles, all right, fine. Like, he's a pretty skinny guy. He's not he's got more length than you would expect. He's taller than you think, but not strong. But you have enough quickness that, and enough ability to pressure the ball with that small unit that they can't just enter it into the post. I mean, and how many power forwards are there really that you're going to say, all right, him posting up C.J. Miles and getting on the defensive glass is going to kill you more than C.J. Miles getting wide open threes because the guy doesn't have it in his head to close out to the 3-point line? That's a pretty short list of names.
Yeah, I the way I like to think about that is instincts. And the instinct that are required as a power forward to defend C.J. Miles are just not something most of those guys have in their repertoire. It's something that players of that size and that position are going to have to start developing, because guys are going to be playing that position, whether they're playing kind of out of position or they're just going to have that skill set. But for right now, he can really take advantage of that. And also, the Pacers have the right combination of players outside of Miles that, if that matchup happens, that they can handle it. They have guys like George Hill, Paul George. I mean, Stuckey and Monte aren't perfect with that, but they have guys who are capable defenders who can move quickly enough that they can, try to mitigate that without sacrificing everything else on the court.
Yeah, and the Pacers, by the way, 12-7 now, 3-2 in their last five, but since that encompassed a West Coast trip, no shame there. They lost an overtime classic to Utah over
what
the weekend.
What a game. That was one of the best games, one of the most
exciting
games
of the season. I missed that one, sadly. So the Clippers, Lance Stephenson's current employer, 11-9 now, 4-2 over their last six, which is not horrendous considering that Redick, as soon as he came back from his back issue, then he sprained his left ankle. Paul had the groin issue, then has had a rib cartilage issue that he's missed a few games with now. They were able to come back from way down against the Magic last night, which was a key win. Did you see any of that game, by the way? I missed the end of that.
I missed that game. I had other obligations. But one thing that's been kind of weird to me about the Clippers is that, since the last time recorded, their schedule is just kind of soft. Like, they had a home run against the Jazz, which they lost, the Pelicans, the Wolves, the Blazers, and then they had a justifiable home loss to the Pacers, but again, it was home game. And then a home against the Magic. So it was like, not only were they playing home games, but they weren't playing home games against particularly good teams. And so they, 4-2 is not a problem. It's not.
Yeah,
it's not
but
like
with any... Paul and Redick out, I mean, I think if they had neither of those guys for a full season, This is like maybe a 500 team, maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
So 4-2 is not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad. Yeah, I think that's definitely fair. But they're a team that it's so weird that you would think that if you just threw a bunch of stuff against the wall, that something would fit. They're kind of two different issues. So one is the fifth starter, and then the other one is just having everybody but the other four guys and whoever's the fifth starter just playing a functional unit, especially if you're going to hockey sub like Doc does, which I don't support. And they've basically, with all the stuff that's stuck to the wall, or that they threw at the wall, very little of it is sticking right now.
Yeah, and, you know, you look at their kind of their five principal bench guys, Rivers, Crawford, Stevenson, Paul Pierce, Josh Smith. Those are guys who, maybe with the exception, Rivers and Stevenson, you know, and even Crawford, you can wax and wane on. But I think we've kind of talked about the sort of like just the team rating, like bar, like lineup strength bars that, you know, you would see when you would be about to select a team in like an NBA video game. And so you think about, all right, you know, these are like five players that you could say are, all right, okay bench players. But you look at, all right, no passing really at all, right, on that unit, right? Spot up shooting. Yeah, maybe Pierce is okay at that. But, you know, there's no one to pass in the ball if he is, right? Shot blocking. Smith is pretty much done in that category. You got just about nothing. You know, just sort of like overall defensive intelligence, not really much there, right? So I mean, you've got guys who, you know, if you were playing a video game, you'd just be, all right, you know, I'm going to give it to these guys, let them take turns. But when you're actually trying to construct an effective lineup out of those players, it doesn't work as well as it does on paper.
You're right, and it's a challenge for them also moving forward, because this is, as we've talked about before, why we were kind of impressed with their offseason, is this is a team that has limited tools to get better unless they're going to do something really bold. And these are the types of moves that a team like that has to make. It's just that they haven't worked out.
All right, let's move on to the now 3-17 LA Lakers. Second worst record in the association, 1-5 since we last checked in on them. You've actually seen them in person twice, once since we last recorded, once at Golden State and then once against the Wizards, a game they actually won. I'll just turn it over to you here. What are your thoughts on where this team is at right now?
They're terrible. Straight up, they're terrible. I mean, what was so kind of...
And that's even after seeing a game that they won,
they
right?
They won. So what I kept on thinking about during that game against the Wizards was they weren't playing that much better than they did against the Warriors. It's just that some of the shots they took went in, which is wonderful. I mean, it was thrilling for me, kind of, as somebody who went to college in L.A., for a period of time. I'm not a Kobe, you know, fan or stan in any way, but it was nice to see him drop 30. The crowd was actually kind of pro Lakers at that point. So they were doing that, and their defense wasn't stopping anything. It's just that the Wizards were throwing the ball around like crazy people and were giving them easier looks. And so basically, like what I said when we saw the Lakers just get walloped by the Warriors was, if you make two actions or passes against them, you're going to get an open look. And that was still true. It was just that sometimes on the first action, John Wall was just throwing the ball to the bench or whatever. Or one of the things that somebody near me brought up, which I think was a great point, I can't remember who, was that Wall is still at the point in his development where he sometimes he'll think, oh, well, this is going to be the right play, like when the play starts, and then he'll make the pass, but then it's just not there. And the Lakers have enough scoring talent, particularly Lou Williams had some nice moments in this game, where, you know, if you give them that look, if you give them a 2-on-1 in transition, they're going to score. But their defense, that they weren't thriving because their defense was good. Their defense was terrible. And I think that what I want to see with them is something that we've talked about before, is just, are they going to be able to, particularly defensively, are they going to be able to get enough from the spots that are they do not have a committed long-term piece to justify that foundation? Or are they going to need to think about whether it would probably be Jordan Clarkson, but it be somebody that is probably not going to be a starter?
But so who are the names you're talking about here?
So Clark, the three guys that I think they should be thinking about as evaluating as potential long-term starters are Julius Randle, D'Angelo Russell, Jordan Clarkson. I don't really think there's anybody else on this team that, let's say, 3 years from now has a reasonable chance of being a starter. I mean, maybe Larry Nance gets there, maybe a couple other guys, but I think those are really the three.
Yeah, or even really a rotation guy. Maybe you could see, I mean, Nance was drafted to be, you know, an energy
guy.
Yeah,
sure.
Off
the I, think,
which,
I think Nance...
Which with the 27th pick, if you can
absolutely.
Get that, that's actually
I think
totally
he'll
good.
Be. I think he can be a nice 15-minute a game offensive rebound, yeah. tip
if
dunk.
If he can make threes, he can be an effective player.
Absolutely. But so if you're thinking about those three guys, so part of what you need to figure out is who's a starter? Like who's good enough that on the next great or even very good Lakers team, these are guys that are going to be good enough to be starters on that team. And that doesn't mean they're starters forever or starters for life or anything like that. Then you have to – so that's kind of the first evaluation. Then you have to think about, okay, well, if those guys are going to be together, what are your strengths and weaknesses? So what do we need to think about for other stuff? And, of course, I'm somebody who always thinks – take best player available unless it's like some sort of direct conflict and the next player is similar quality. But what I'm thinking is Clarkson, let's say the even they determine that Clarkson, Russell, and Randle are all starter quality. They're going to need so much defensive ability from the other two guys that it might not be workable. It might be, but it might not be.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I do think that Russell, especially when you consider just how toxic this environment is actually doing okay.
Sure, you know I mean? Agree with
he's
you.
He's playing a fair amount of minutes. He's not embarrassing himself. You know, he's not getting to the basket a ton. But, you know, he's got all these other guys. You know, they're not playing to his strengths with spread pick and roll or anything like that. He's actually, you know, and Kevin Pelton has been making this point, especially when you consider that point guards kind of take longer to develop than a lot of other positions. You know, you can count really on probably two hands the number of point guards who have actually been like effective NBA players as rookies. You know, I mean, among guys who are in the league right now, you could probably point to like Chris Paul and Kyrie are really like the only guys. And even Kyrie, I'm sure, was bad enough defensively that he probably gave back most of his heroics offensively. And those are the only guys I can remember off the top of my head who were actually good as rookie point guards, you know, so or even close to being good.
My question to you, I don't know how much you've seen of them recently, is do you feel comfortable with D'Angelo Russell guarding ones long-term, or do you think he'll be more of somebody who defends twos, regardless of offensive role?
I think that Clarkson probably has a little bit quicker of feet and a little bit more of a competitive instinct and ability to get over ball screens than Russell does. So I think he's probably more likely to be the guy who will defend ones. But until we get a real coach in there, it's really hard to judge those guys.
Yeah, I did get a little bit of a chuckle. Before the Wizards game, somebody asked Byron Scott about D'Angelo Russell, and he basically said, you know, like, he's not as ready as – or, like, he didn't come in as ready as Chris Paul and Kyrie did because he, you know, he coached both those guys. And – And I thought I chuckled a little bit just because
that's true, right? Wow, like yeah, Byron Scott has coached both of those guys. That's right. Remarkable.
And so, I mean, obviously, it makes sense with Chris Paul because Chris Paul played in college and all that, and he was one of the most prepped pros that I can remember at that position. Kyrie was about the same age and had less college experience, but I mean, I think that they had very
yeah.
different paths.
But Kyrie also, I mean, the thing to remember about him is that he's basically, you know, he's never even really been that great of a distributor, like.
Yeah, his skills and his skill set was already
score,
there.
Right? You know, he's not really running the team. Like, that's not how he was successful in his rookie year.
Yeah, I mean, he's has a great handle. He's had it since then, and his jumper has gotten better. But, well, I mean, Kyrie, one of my biggest criticisms of him is that he hasn't improved as much as we hoped he would because, you know, usually guys who start as strong
I think,
as he
I think he did last year. I think he did.
Yeah, if he can play like he did that kind of that good stretch at the end of the year and in that game one of the finals, I think was defensively like one of the best.
Well, yeah, I think we've just, because he had such a injury-marred playoffs, I think we kind of forgot about.
But he's so
he
physically talented. I mean, I love the guy. Yeah. I mean, but what I'm kind of concerned about with Russell is just, you know, I think that his offensive game actually works a lot better if he can have two guards on him. I think that would be, because then he gets a little bit, it's a little bit easier for him to get separation, and he's being guarded by guys who aren't used to playing on ball as much, which I actually think would be really cool. But you need,
I don't know if I agree with that or not. I'll have to think about that.
Yeah, you have, but you need the right guy next to him to make that actually work. I mean, there are people who can do it, but you need to figure that out. But I think that's enough on the Lakers now. We'll move on to Memphis.
Well, one more note, though. You remember Kobe's glorious 31-point game when he was a whole 10 out of 24 from the field and, you know, got to the line a few times? Don't worry, he's still really bad. He shot 2-for-15 tonight.
Oh, yeah, I mean.
Don't worry, he's not. I mean,
the shots that he made in that game against the Wizards, they weren't any different, particularly than the shots against the Warriors. They just went in, you know, like that.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
he looked like he had
large numbers, basically.
He had slightly better lift, and he had a guy in Beal on him who wasn't going to block his shot.
Played the two a lot more, which was important. Like that's something that I think you talked about it with KP was that, and I'm calling him KP. Porzingis has other names. I thought was a really good point. I think it was in that podcast was about how I think Kobe is hurt a lot by playing small forward because he can't do a lot of the things that he has a positional advantage on.
Yeah, that's true. All right, let's get to the Grizzlies. The last one we're going to do for today, 12-9, turned it around after that dreadful 3-6 start. They are 4-2 in their last six. So let's say, all right, let's be as charitable as we can. You shouldn't do this as an analyst because all the games have statistical meaning. Just throwing out certain games is usually not a good idea. You want to have as big a sample as possible usually, especially with them when it's not like some big thing has changed that you can point to. I'm not, I'm not counting Chalmers as that, but let's just look at their last 11. Still only a 2.4 net rating. 100 defensive rating, which would rank pretty close to the league average, maybe slightly above. 103 offensive rating, you know, again, slightly above league average. And, you know, that's kind of how I see this team now, is sort of like, you know, one of those teams, 45-win team, 47-win team. You know, that's about where you are with that kind of a net rating. And, you know, they still overall in the season have a negative point differential. But, you know, so they're kind of lucky to be 12-9. But, yeah, I mean, I still think 47 wins from this team, and just the fact that they, you know, had won 8 of 10 or something at one point doesn't particularly convince me. I mean, because they're not at the point where like they're blowing teams out or really like beating good teams. And one of the other things that I thought about watching them get killed by the Spurs was this is a team that offensively they can do okay against mediocre to bad defenses, but against good defenses, they just have no chance at all.
Agreed. I think the best way to put it for me is that they're fine, but I think that if they, you know, we talked about how, you know, some major players are going to get hurt. It feels like to me like they're a team that would be DOA if, let's say, Marc Gasol missed 20 games or 20 or more, or Conley. Like, I mean, Mario Chalmers has played pretty well with them. I've been very impressed. He did nicely today, too. But they don't have that many guys that other teams just really have to game plan for. And as you talked about, their team defense now isn't that thing either. You know, it used to be that, oh, well, they're going to have a great defensive team and then they'll get something from, you know, from Zach or from Mark or from Mike Conley. And they're just not at that point now. And I think that what you said about the defenses is particularly astute. But they can, you know, they can beat teams that will beat themselves, kind of like what happened with the Suns today. They'll get, you know, they'll get those games. But, you know, I kind of feel in a way, though they do it in a very different way, that it's kind of like the Celtics, where, you know, they might get in, but I won't really think of them as much more than that.
Yeah, and Marc Gasol, he was a guy who was recently, as last March, I ranked number 9 in the NBA. And granted, that was kind of a tier below the guys above him, which were Blake Griffin and DeMarcus Cousins for me at that point. But I think he's performed it significantly below that level this year. I mean, to the point where when we were talking about first team all NBA centers on our awards podcast from Thursday, his name didn't even come up, and I think rightfully so.
Agreed. Yeah, I don't think it really did. And this is a year where that center crop, we talked about it, it's not particularly strong. It was by far the hardest position to fill. It wasn't like we were choosing between, you know, like Kyle Lowry was a hard omission just because the two guys above him were better. He wasn't even in the conversation of a weak crop.
All right, let's call it quits for now. We will be back again tomorrow to do the rest of the league in a little bit more depth since we missed out on one of these podcasts. In the meantime, if you'd like to support the program, a nice iTunes review or rating, very, very helpful in terms of both warming our hearts and hopefully the review will actually be good. And also just helping us to get some sponsors. You know, I think people look at those iTunes rankings, and we've been doing pretty well there, and the reviews are a component of that. Also, patronizing our fine sponsors. Today it was DraftKings with the cap space code, all one word, easy to remember, since we talk about cap space all the time on the program. And you could also follow Danny or I on Twitter. I am Nate Duncan NBA. Follow Danny or me on Twitter, since I'm the object there.
Correct.
I'm Nate Duncan NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. And I will not bore you with any further grammar screw-ups. Talk to you all next time.